This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. President Trump is hearing strong pushback from Capitol Hill after his sudden decision to pull back U.S. troops in northern Syria. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The move essentially abandoned Syrian Kurd fighters who were among the best U.S. allies against Islamic State militants. Turkey sees them as terrorists, and the president's move frees Turkish forces to attack the Kurds. He's warning Turkey not to go too far, but sees his move as fulfilling a campaign pledge to bring American troops home from endless war.
There has to be an end game.
And says the U.S. has done its job.
We defeated ISIS.
But he's facing unusually strong criticism from Republican allies like Lindsey Graham.
ISIS is not defeated, my friend.
Who tells Fox and Friends this all but invites the militants to return. Other Republicans call the president's decision a catastrophic mistake and a disaster. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Three Democratic committees are demanding the Defense Secretary and Office of Budget and Management Acting Director turn over the documents by October 15th. Democrats are investigating President Trump's actions of pressing Ukraine to investigate his Democratic rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Part of the investigation includes examining whether or not Trump's decision to withhold military aid to Ukraine was tied to his request for Ukrainian investigation into the Bidens. Trump has strongly denied any wrongdoing. A second U.S. intelligence whistleblower has also come forward with a complaint about actions of the Trump administration. Meantime, the impeachment inquiry is moving forward this week, with two congressional committees set to hear testimony from several important figures. For details on more news, please join us, voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Police clashed with protesters in Hong Kong Monday in another night of unrest. Earlier in the day, two protesters were charged with violating Hong Kong's new ban on wearing masks at rallies. The mask ban has led to more anger, with rallies and widespread violence over the last 3 days. Police said the public order of the whole city is being pushed to the verge of a very dangerous situation. Protesters are upset at what they say is Beijing's increasing influence over Hong Kong, which was promised a high level of autonomy when it returned to Chinese rule, that is, back in 1997. Ethiopian Airlines' former chief engineer filed a whistleblower complaint on the March crash of a Boeing MAX jet. Get more on the story from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
A former top employee of Ethiopian Airlines has filed a whistleblower complaint with regulators in which he says someone got into maintenance records that should have been locked one day after the March crash of a Boeing 737 MAX jet that killed all 157 people on board. Jonas Yeshenu resigned as Ethiopian Airlines chief engineer this summer. He's seeking asylum in the United States, in part because he says speaking out against the government-owned airline can lead to imprisonment.
If you are in jail, mean you will be beaten. You will be tortured.
Yeshenu also tells the Associated Press Ethiopian Airlines mechanics are overworked and pressed to take shortcuts, and pilots fly on too little rest and not enough training. I'm Mike Gracia.
A bomb blast in eastern Afghanistan killed at least 10 people, including a child, on Monday. An Afghan official says the attack targeted a minibus carrying new army recruits. The official says the attack in Jalalabad City wounded some 27 others. U.S. utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric said it may be forced to cut power to most of Northern California later this week in order to prevent wildfires. The National Weather Service has issued a fire weather warning. PG&E is exercising extreme caution after its power line sparked a blaze that destroyed nearly 19,000 buildings, killed 85 people, and ravaged the town of Paradise last year. Last month, the company paid some $11 billion to insurance companies for claims stemming from wildfires sparked by its equipment back in 2017 and 2018, including the one in Paradise. For more news, please join us, voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October the 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mauritius Prime Minister dissolves parliament and calls new elections.
The mandate of the government was 5 years, and it expires in December this year. So we are going to elections as we should normally do in a democracy.
Rashmita Band is an advisor to Mauritius Prime Minister. Malawi's president will hold a rally today in the capital Lilongwe amid ongoing electoral dispute. Hundreds from Kenya's Sengwe community protested on Monday against eviction from their ancestral land. Rwandan authorities arrest a U.S. pastor, and Liberians in the U.S. launch a 10,000 signature petition against a dual citizenship bill in Liberia.
I think Liberians abroad should be allowed to further participate in what is happening back home, because the country at this time needs everybody on board, whether you are at home or whether you live abroad.
Martha Washington is a former Truth and Reconciliation Commission member, and advocacy groups in Nigeria's River State reached an agreement with Italian oil giant Eni. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mauritius Prime Minister Pravin Kumar Jugnauth this week dissolved parliament and called an early election in November to seek a second five-year term. Analysts say the prime minister is likely to win the election due to investments his administration has undertaken. Rashmita Band, advisor to the prime minister, says he is confident Prime Minister Jugnauth will be re-elected because his policies have improved living standards.
Parliament was dissolved in the normal course of democracy. The mandate of the government was 5 years, and it expires in December this year. So we are going to elections as we should normally do in a democracy. The electoral campaign would last for about 1 month, and I am pretty sure that this period is quite convenient for major political parties to put forward their views and their program for the next 5 years. I think that this election is going to be about the economy. I believe this will be the major issue facing the electorate. On the basis of what this government has achieved, I believe that we stand a very good chance of getting the trust of the electorate, because we have delivered on several major issues.
What do you say to critics who say that despite what the government has been saying, the government has failed to keep or deliver promises it made, for which the prime minister was given a five-year mandate, and that it's unlikely that he will get re-elected?
The main item on which we delivered during the past 5 years is to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor. The Gini coefficient, as they call it, which measures the gap between the lower classes and the higher classes, has been considerably reduced during this government through several measures, like, for example, we introduced a minimum wage, and we also have a system called the negative income tax, whereby government gives support in terms of income to people. Well, let's say that we have some major projects, and this is probably the main reason why we are so keen to seek a new mandate.
Some people are saying because of these developments, infrastructure development and programs the government has been implementing, the government is overly eager to go to elections, and that this call for elections or dissolution of parliament is a little early. How do you answer to such criticism?
It is not early. The previous elections were held about 5 years ago. And this is quite a normal mandate, that is, it lasted for 5 years. Well, for some practical reason, it's not exactly 5 years day for day, but it's, I don't find anything which can be considered as an anticipated election. It is quite in the normal course of our constitution, and this is exactly what our constitution says.
Rashmita Band is an advisor to Mauritius Prime Minister Pravin Kumar Jugnauth. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Port Louis. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika is scheduled to hold a rally in the capital, Lilongwe, today, Tuesday, after launching the construction of over 200 schools across the country. The initiative is a partnership between the Malawian government and the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. Some analysts say they expected the president to choose the rally to help ease ongoing political tensions in the country due to an ongoing dispute over the outcome of the May 21st general election. Mark Botemani is Malawi's information minister.
The main thrust of tomorrow's event is not necessarily the rally that you have heard about. He is actually launching a very big project in the education sector, which is the construction of 260 secondary schools across the country. And the government of Malawi is doing that in conjunction with the USAID. So the head of state and government, Professor Afakira Mutharika, will be leading Malawians in launching that project in somewhere around the city of Lilongwe, the place called Kaware. Because he's going out to launch the project, obviously this is a public, public event. He's taken advantage of that same, event to talk to the people. And that is why perhaps you may have felt that he's holding a rally. Yes, I can confirm, but that will be done after the launch of the 260 secondary schools.
But some people are of the view, when reports came that the president was holding a rally Tuesday in Lilongwe, is that there's tension in the country and they expect the president to use a platform to help ease the political tension in the country so it doesn't plunge the country into crisis. What do you make of such concerns being expressed by Malawians?
I think you must understand that the president is, is leading this country. He's the president of the country, and he is at liberty to hold any public event anywhere he wants in Malawi. He cannot be restrained to do that. He's constitutionally, set up as the president of the republic, and so I don't think there's anything that can restrain him to meet his people. And so this is the opportunity that he has. He's holding a government, function, and then later on he'll be talking to the people. So we don't see that there is any problem in that.
What does the president seek to specifically address in the unveiling of the partnership with USAID as well as holding the rally Tuesday?
Obviously I cannot preempt the contents of his message to Malawians because I haven't seen it. But the president, since his election, has been going around the country holding public rallies and of course engaging in various government activities. And so I would assume that tomorrow he'll be talking to Malawians just to encouraging them and of course talking about his agenda for the next 5 years, and that's what he'll be doing. So it is not actually out of anything else. He'll continue to encourage Malawians and to continue to impress upon Malawians to continue working hard and support his government.
They have been presenting petitions. Why wouldn't the government meet them to address their concern, even if the government deems it unnecessary?
No, I don't know how you want government to address their concerns, because their agenda is one. They're saying that the chairperson of Malawi Electoral Commission must resign. But I don't know how would she resign when she has not been found guilty of any wrongdoing. It doesn't make sense at all to government.
Mark Botemani is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October the 8th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Rwandan authorities on Monday arrested an American missionary who ran a conservative and evangelical church and radio station in the country. Pastor Greg Shuv's arrest came shortly before he was to address a news conference to denounce the government for clamping down on churches like his. Yuji Uwimana has details from Kigali.
Just put it down, Timmy, put it down.
Despite his plea of innocence, American pastor Greg Shuv was handcuffed and arrested while preparing to hold a news conference to announce his departure from Rwandan soil. Modeste Mbabazi, the spokesperson of the Rwanda Investigation Bureau, told VOA that the police handed the pastor Shuv to the investigative bureau for questioning. He says Rwanda Investigation Bureau has him. He's being interrogated. We're investigating him on allegations of violating public order as well as organizing unlawful gatherings. Before being arrested, Pastor Shouf distributed a 3-page press statement entitled Before I Leave, where he explains the genesis of his conflict with the Rwandan government.
Before we get broken up, just pass out to your neighbor, please.
The statement reads, this month we'll be moving to Kampala because immigration refused to renew our visas. I actually have not spoken very much during this mess because my lawyer and I both agreed that we would quietly allow court to do their job in peace. But since this was not productive, I want to explain what was done to us. The statement goes on to explain what the pastor says are attacks on his radio and church. Pastor Shufu's problem started when a journalist on his Christian radio Amazing Grace was accused of allegedly undermining women. The Rwanda Media Commission accused the journalist of calling women evil. But Pastor Greg says the sermon was talking about churches.
RMC has lied greatly and taken the words of Nicholas totally out of context. He was never talking about women, never. He was talking about churches. In real simple, in the Bible, a good woman represents a good church. A bad woman represents a bad church. That's it. That was the message.
Pastor Greg has been criticizing different Rwandan directives, including the one of shutting down 700,000 churches, legal abortion, the use of contraceptive methods in schools, among many others. Above all, he says the Rwandan government is violating the constitution. This government has taken a stand against God with its heathen practices. I hope Christians will do their lawful part and help fix these problems, concludes statement. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Hundreds of people from Kenya's Sangwe community protested on Monday against eviction from their ancestral land. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the community wants the government to recognize them as the original inhabitants of the land.
In the petition that was presented in the office of the president, the community said they have been sidelined for many years now by successive governments. They say rangers from the Kenya Forest Service who killed one of them, Robert Kiprotich, last year, must be brought to book. A protester, Yator Kiptum, said that the government should provide security for the people in Imbubut Forest who, he says, have been neglected.
We want our right to be recognized.
Over 150 members of the community traveled more than 400 kilometers from Elgeyo Marakwet in the Great Rift Valley to Nairobi on Monday and presented a petition to the office of the president. In solidarity with the Sengwer community, Amnesty International Kenya Executive Director Horton Irungu said that the people should be allowed to return to their ancestral land and that they should not be sidelined since they don't have economic impact to Kenya as well as political representation.
As Amnesty International Kenya, we are here today to provide solidarity and to give courage to the Sengwe community. They are one of about 10 indigenous communities. In number, they probably range about 50,000 people. It's a very small community. Their community is not considered by economists to be a big economic value to this country, nor are they considered to be politically very, very powerful. But they are Kenyans and they deserve their rights like any other Kenyan.
The government has been evicting Kenyans living in forest areas in the country. Over the weekend, a Kenya Forest Service officer was attacked and injured by communities living in Mau Forest during the eviction that is ongoing in the area. Mr. Irungu says division of the community brought about poverty and segregation in some of the communities, especially the indigenous ones.
They divided our communities into those they thought were productive for the colonial empire and those that they thought were not productive. The ones who were not productive were chased from their lands, they were removed from their livelihoods, and as a result, they ended up in some of the most poorest situations. As Amnesty International, we have also supported them, calling on the president to recognize these people as being legitimate, as being honorable people of Kenya.
The government has been blaming the communities living in the forest in the country for environment destruction that it claims has also brought about climate change. The presentation of the petition took place as the world commemorates United Nations Global Day for Housing and Shelter World Habitat Day. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Some Liberians in the United States have launched a 10,000-signature petition drive to overturn a dual citizenship bill passed by the Liberian legislature. According to the bill, a natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country but shall not qualify for any elected or appointed positions such as a cabinet and Supreme Court Chief Justice and Associate Justices. A referendum on the bill will take place next year. Liberian law requires 10,000 signatures to prevent a bill from being placed on the referendum agenda. Martha Washington is a former member of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission and a supporter of the petition.
I'm supporting the bill because I think it's a good thing. Liberians in the diaspora have been very active in the post-war reconstruction of Liberia. And to see our legislators come together to craft a bill that will, in a lot of ways, disenfranchise Liberians in the diaspora, I think it's unfortunate. I'm hoping that when it goes out there for the national referendum, that ordinary Liberians will really reject it.
Masa, at the core of this bill is the issue of whether Liberians in diaspora, who the bill considered to be citizens, whether they can also hold elected or appointed positions.
I think Liberians abroad should be allowed to fully participate in what is happening back home, because the country at this time needs everybody on board, whether you are at home or whether you live abroad. And let's also remember that the over majority of Liberians in these United States and other parts of the diaspora, many of them were forced to flee the country of Liberia because of the Civil War under all sort of harsh conditions and find their lives the best way to cool in foreign land. And then you want to come back and punish them. The contribution that Liberians in the diaspora has made or continue to make to that country. It is reported that the Liberian diaspora is probably the second highest that, you know, send money back home to their people, and that money assists.
I wanted to ask that because over the weekend, I listened to some Liberians talked about this particular dual citizenship bill, and some people were even suggesting that if the legislators do not reverse course, that Liberians here who do send money to their relatives at home should protest by not sending money home directly.
I think people should do what they need to do peacefully to send a clear message that we are not going to accept this intentional marginalization of Liberians. There's so many ways Liberians can try to make the government listen to them, and that is one way. Now, whether I will agree for it or not is left with those Liberians who think that's the best recourse. But I think Liberians should not take this bill lying down. I think we should be very vocal about it.
I spoke last week with someone who was also against the bill as it is. Also, I spoke to another Liberian who had been an advocate for this dual citizenship. And he sounded kind of middle of the road to say, well, James, I think Liberians have to accept the bill as it is now because it's a step forward. How united are Liberians?
That is a tricky question because, James, you know how we are as a people. Liberians are extremely very independent-minded. But I think I see more support for this petition. I see more support and I see more outcry against this bill than those who might be supporting it or those who might be, you know, sitting on the fence with it.
I know you support the petition and you are not the originator of the petition. The aim was to get 10,000 signatures. How are you all doing?
We're doing good. By now, I think we got more than 5,000 already. The petition just came out on the weekend. So we will get more than 10,000 signatures, definitely.
Masa, thank you very much again. Very happy to speak with you, always.
Thank you, James.
Masa Washington is a former Truth and Reconciliation Commission member. She was speaking with us from Philadelphia. Community organizers and advocacy groups of Agard Village in Nigeria's River State announced on Tuesday that they have reached an agreement with the Italian oil giant Eni. The community says they have for decades suffered floods due to poorly constructed facilities by Eni. They reached the settlement through an Italian agency called the National Contact Point, which hears complaints about Italian companies. Jonathan Kaufman is executive director of Advocates for Community Alternatives.
Every year in Aga, water that used to flow freely through the town backs up when it reaches the company's elevated roadways, which it built a few decades ago, and then floods the entire town. And you see houses falling down. It destroys farmland. It creates these hidden sinkholes, which are hazards to children and even grown people who can't swim well. People die fairly often. Disease rates skyrocket because of the waterborne illnesses. And this happens literally every year.
To clarify, it's every year since these elevated roadways were built by ENI.
That's right. That's right. So according to the people in the village, this didn't used to happen. And yes, it is a rainy area. And yes, floods happen in the Niger Delta area. But the people of Aga say they were not a flooded community until the roadways and the other elevated facilities were built by ENI. And for years, they tried many different things to get ENI to do something about it. They protested. They would ask for meetings. There were even some lawsuits that kind of ended inconclusively. And as a result, the only thing that they ever saw was a few times ENI would dig some extra culverts that would go under the roadways, but it was never nearly enough to drain away the huge amount of water that was completely inundating the town. When we got involved, when I say we, it's my organization, Advocates for Community Alternatives, working with the International Federation of Human Rights, FIDH, and a Nigerian lawyer, Chima Williams, and an Italian lawyer, Giacomo Cremonesi. What we said to them was, you know, one of the problems that you're having is that you're only dealing with the local subsidiary. ENI has a Nigerian company called NAOC, Nigerian Agip Oil Company. And when you're just working at that level, that company, it's easy for them to ignore you. But if we can take this issue back to Italy and make it a problem for the parent company too, then it's more likely that they'll take you seriously. So that's how we went to the national contact point in Italy. And we said it can't just be the subsidiary that answers. It has to be the parent company, because the parent company has these internationally recognized responsibilities not to subject communities to human rights harms like what we're seeing in these communities.
What was the agreement that was reached? And what will happen in the future, hopefully?
Yeah, so the agreement provides that ENI will, on an urgent basis, come into the community, survey the situation, and build urgent drainage solutions. It doesn't dictate exactly what those are because it's a technical issue, right? Everything relates to what's the lay of the land. Is it hilly? Is it flat? Where you need to build things? Is it a channel? Is it a drain? But they are right now, their surveys are already in the community trying to decide exactly what it is that's going to be built right away. But the real key is that we don't just have to take ENI's word for it. If what they do now isn't doing the trick, then they've agreed that together we will decide on an independent technical expert who will be able to make recommendations for what a real lasting solution to the flooding is.
Jonathan Kaufman is Executive Director of Advocates for Community Alternatives. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Accra. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. Mauritius Prime Minister Pravin Kumar Jugnauth this week dissolved parliament and called an election in November to seek a second five-year term. Analysts say the prime minister is likely to win the election due to investments his administration has undertaken. Malawian President Arthur Mutharika is scheduled to hold a rally in the capital Lilongwe today, Tuesday, after launching the construction of over 200 schools across the country. The initiative is a partnership between the Malawian government and the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. And some Liberians in the United States have launched a 10,000-signature petition drive to overturn a dual citizenship bill passed by the Liberian legislature. According to the bill, a natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country but shall not qualify for any elected or appointed positions. That is it for this Tuesday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.